Crime, Wine, and Chaos contains adult language and graphic content. Listener discretion is advised.
Game on, Chaos Kids. Chaos Kids. I'm Amber.
And I'm Naomi. And this is Crime, Wine, and Chaos.
God, fuck. Man, sister.
Here we are.
Jesus. Car. Game on. My God. It's the best. It's been a day, sister.
Has it? You had a long one. You did some mandatory fun time for work?
Yeah, I did mandatory fun time. It was good. The irony is like the most of like the crux of it was like I won't bore you with the $5 story, but my boss, who's phenomenal, teaches these like interaction styles and motivation styles. And so we're kind of like, anyway, it's very obvious that I'm an introvert and I'm like a behind the scenes person. And so to have a day where you're supposed to like talk about yourself nonstop I get like, speaking of that book I was telling you about, I do have a point. Highly sensitive people. She coined a term that I was like, I felt so seen. She describes it as an emotional hangover.
Oh, yeah. I've heard
and
it.
So,
we talk about emotional hangovers.
Yes. So when I've had a day that's really people-y, or when I'm sharing discussions that are heavy or things that are important to me or just really, really stressed, I get like an emotional hangover that lasts probably longer than the average person. You know what I mean? Like, I then I just have a hard time like doing much of anything. So that's where I'm at today. So you're welcome that you get the best of me.
We're in the emotional hangover now. Is that what you're telling me?
Listen, I sat in a boardroom with 5 engineers all day.
Oh, condolences.
They are wonderful humans. I just, you know, a lot of nerding out about math and stuff and...
Sister, this like 20 years of my life.
I just like, ooh, this is a lot of togetherness here. But it was good. I'm just tired.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's good. Well,
yeah.
You know,
how about you?
I'm okay. You know, I did that extra long, you know, weekend away with the ladies down in LA and had a pretty good time, ate a bunch of good food. We went to the Getty. Have you ever heard of that place?
No.
It's a museum. It's a big fancy museum up in the hills, like above LA, and it has these like stunning views, like all the way to the ocean from up on the hillside. And it's huge. This place is huge and it's full of like, I'm not an art person per se. So like, I couldn't really tell you too much about what we saw, except that, you know, it was like, a lot of it was like Italian, from like the 15 to 1700s or something. I don't know. There was some really cool stuff though. There was some really, really cool stuff and we had a good time. And then, you know, just a lot of couch time with a couple of my favorites. So
that's the best.
Yeah. It was really good. I was a little nervous, obviously, about the flying in light of the fact that all the Boeing planes are falling out of the sky and falling apart now.
Oh, God.
I don't think I will be flying again for a long time unless it's an Airbus. That's if
really?
I can make sure it's, yeah, no, I'm legit. Like, legit. Mm. You heard about the whistleblower, right?
Yes. I fly out to LA on Saturday morning. So,
are you flying on a Boeing?
I'm going to check now. We'll circle back to this conversation tomorrow when we record. I will check. but. Yeah, you know, I need another thing to contribute to my neuroses.
I know, I'm sorry, but like this is
okay.
Like real. And you know, I'm not a nervous flyer at all. I never have been. Like flying does not bother me. I've flown plenty, but now I'm really not looking to get on a Boeing anytime soon. So
that makes sense. Well, yeah. I have no choice. So thoughts and prayers.
I know. You know what? We made it. So maybe you'll make it. You know, the last incident happened right before we came home and the plane landed just fine. They just realized they lost a piece mid-flight, but no one got hurt. It was fine.
Oh, my God. Okay. Well, So to dovetail from there, I'm drinking.
What are you drinking?
It's called Seven Moons. It's a red blend from California.
Uh-huh.
It made the flight over.
And a partridge in a pear tree.
Yeah. And hopefully both wings intact. Yeah. God. Great. I hear you have a doozy for me.
You know what? Okay. So here's the deal. Remember when I told you the story about the family, the Wilsons in Bellevue, that were all murdered by those two boys?
Yes. The goth kids.
Goth, quote unquote.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, remember how I told you that I found that story while I was looking for another one?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I found the one I was actually looking for.
Okay, great.
Okay. And one of the reasons why I remember this is because years ago saw a documentary about this, and it was the first time I'd ever heard about it. Or it was like it rang the tiniest little bell. Okay, so here we go. It is summer of 1994 in Bellevue, Washington. You guys, I know we do a lot of Bellevue stories around here.
Who knew there were so many?
There's more than you think. So it's summer of 1994 in Bellevue, Washington. Atif Rafay and his bestie, Sebastian Burns, are in town visiting Atif's family while these two friends are on summer break after their freshman year in college.
Okay.
The two young men had been best friends since high school. Sebastian was raised in a loving family with English roots and grew up playing the cello. He was very smart. His sister, Tiffany, who would go on to be a television reporter with the CBS station in Cleveland, Ohio, said that Sebastian was what you would call intellectual. Sebastian's high school sweetheart, Sarah Isaacs, said that Sebastian and Atif were friends because they were both precocious and very intelligent. Sebastian joined the Royal Canadian Air Cadets and received an award given to him by Prince Edward.
Jeez.
Atif was attending Cornell University.
Smarty pants.
The Rafay family had very recently moved to Bellevue from Vancouver, BC, into the upscale neighborhood of Somerset late in the year in 1993. This is very close to the park where Alex Baranier and David Anderson murdered Kimberly Wilson before murdering the rest of the Wilson family 4 years later in 1997.
Is this in like the Newcastle area?
Sort of. It's close.
Okay. 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 Yes.
Atif's mom, Sultana, had a doctorate in nutrition and had devoted her life to raising her very gifted son and a disabled daughter, Atif's older sister, Basma, who was autistic and had basically been nonverbal her whole life. Mm-hmm. And their dad, Tariq, was a structural engineer who had worked on buildings all around the world. He was described as extremely intelligent, a devout Muslim who wrote poetry. Tariq and Sultana had met in college where they both attended Colorado State University, like 20 years prior.
Wow.
On the evening of July 12th.
Your birthday?
My birthday.
Oh, no.
1994. So I would have turned 16 that year.
Okay, so we've talked about this before. I'm interjecting.
How old would I be?
You would have been turning 16 that year, because I would have been 14 that year.
Right.
Do you ever, I know we've talked about this before, when something horrific happens on a day that was like memorable for you in some way, I always do this thing where I'm like, fuck, while this was happening to them, I was doing this.
Totally.
And it's so jarring and spooky. Like the
I have no idea what I did on my 16th birthday, Amber.
I bet you were probably out looping it up.
Probably.
Meanwhile, a stone's throw away, something terrible was happening.
Something very terrible was happening.
Okay. Yeah.
Atif and Sebastian went out for the night in the Rafay family car. At 8:30 p.m., they drove to the Keg to get dinner.
Oh, good.
Mm-hmm. Then they went, you guys, the Keg is a local steakhouse chain. It's actually our dad's like favorite restaurant. Then they went to a 9:50 p.m. showing of The Lion King at the old Factoria Cinemas.
Mm.
And then they headed into Seattle to eat at a diner and they hit up a club. So they were both 18 And as far as I know, there was only, at that time, there was only one all ages club. I was just talking about it this past weekend with Susie and Courtney. I think it was called
Annex.
Yes.
Yes. The Annex. Oh my God.
It might've been the Annex. Anyway, it was 2 a.m. on the morning of July 13th, you know, early morning hours, when the two young men returned to the Rafe home and discovered a horrific scene. This is bad, guys. Sultana, aged 56, Tariq, also aged 56, and Basma, aged 20, were all bludgeoned.
Oh, God.
Sultana and Tariq were dead. Basma was barely clinging to life.
Oh.
Sebastian called the police, and then he and Tariq ran outside to wait for the police, thinking that there might still be an intruder in the house. And the police showed up and quickly secured the crime scene. Mm-hmm. And Detective Gomes was on this case too.
Stop it.
The same detective from the Wilson murder four years later.
He's probably like, what the fuck is happening? Yeah. Oh my God.
Well, this was before the Wilson murder.
Mm. Also, the girl that is nonverbal and she's still alive and she can't do anything to even attempt to call for help.
Right.
Oh my God. That's... makes me want to cry.
So Sultana was found on the floor somewhere. I couldn't figure out exactly where in the house. Tariq was in bed. And that bedroom was covered in blood and tissue everywhere. The floor, the ceiling, blood was tracked all over the house. And bloody footprints were found in the garage. Basma would be rushed to the hospital where she would later die from her injuries, taking any information about what happened with her. It was clear that something like a baseball bat had been used. Tariq was beaten 40 or 50 times.
Oh my God.
His skull was crushed. It was definitely overkill.
Mm-hmm.
Police, of course, immediately questioned Sebastian and Atif at the station. They were examined for blood. The two gave the police their clothes and submitted to an alternative light source test that is able to detect traces of blood, and nothing was found. The Bellevue police did not arrest the boys that night and instead put them up in a hotel with pagers, contact information, and told them to get some sleep.
That's odd. They didn't contact any family members. They're minors. Oh, no, they're 18.
They're 18.
Okay. All right.
And also the Rafes and Sebastian and his family, they're all from Vancouver. So I'm not certain that there's a lot of family in the Bellevue area for them to contact anyway.
Okay.
Police were not certain they fully believed the alibi that the two young men gave them, even though it totally checked out. Everywhere they said they had been, people had seen them and confirmed they'd been there. But it seemed odd to the police that while they remembered in detail their entire evening, they were both pretty vague about the details around coming home to the crime scene. Sebastian, when he called 911, had said there had been a break-in. And while there was some evidence of a struggle-ish, one detective would later say, quote, just looking at that room, you start realizing this looks like someone set it up. Boxes were tipped over, drawers were opened, but nothing appeared to have been gone through. Atif told police that there were items missing from the house, his Discman and a VCR.
A Discman. But they could have been in shock, right?
Right.
I would fucking be in shock.
Right.
I could see myself making a call and just being like, something happened here. Like
Right. Totally. Yeah. So that same detective didn't think that made a ton of sense, that someone came in to steal a Walkman and a VCR and then murdered three people, like brutally, no less. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And then that night, Atif and Sebastian were seen renting movies at a video store, like the night of the 13th, like the, you know, like into the next
after the next to take day. Back to right. their hotel room.
Yeah. And police thought that was sus, but they went and got movies. So on the 14th, police brought them back in for more questions. Well, or came to the hotel and questioned them. I'm not quite sure. But both of them willingly gave statements that were videotaped. Neither this round of questioning nor the one the night before did either of them have a lawyer present. Mm-hmm. One of the questions they had for Atif was why he didn't try to help Basma as she lay dying in her bed, even though he heard her moaning in pain on the other side of her bedroom door.
No.
But again, they both said that they were afraid that there was somebody still in the house and like ran out of the house to wait for the police.
I would probably do the same. That would freak me the fuck out.
Right?
I mean, I don't know. Yeah.
The next day, the 15th of July, the Canadian consulate obtained permission from Bellevue police to return Sebastian and Atif to their families in Canada. So on the 16th, the two boarded a bus back to Vancouver while the Raffaele's extended family gathered in Bellevue for funeral services for Tariq, Sultana, and Basma. And this raised a lot of eyebrows.
But, okay.
But the detectives on the case, as suspicious as they were of these two, did not have enough evidence to prove they had been the killers.
Mm-hmm.
So the detectives worked on building a case based on the demeanor of the two young men in the aftermath. Quote, they cooperated, one detective would later say in an interview. They did everything that was asked of them. However, when they did things, they had this air or this attitude about doing it.
Well, okay. They're also 18-year-old boys and...
Right.
Okay.
Police wondered why the two had sat in front of the house if they believed an intruder might still be inside. Like, I don't know where they thought they should go.
They should go exactly where they think the police are going to pull in.
Right?
Right? Oh, this is not evidence. Okay.
And how was it that Atif even noticed that his Discman and a VCR were missing?
I don't know. Maybe they were both sitting in the front room in plain sight. I don't know. Okay.
And a bit more digging into their past, the detectives discovered that in high school, Sebastian and Atif had been in a play called Rope about two kids who committed the perfect murder, where the murder weapon was a bat. Police were convinced this was chilling information that pointed to inspiration for the two to murder the Rafe family.
This is just getting stupider and stupider. Okay.
Of course, Sebastian's family was firmly on his side. There was no way he had anything to do with it or Atif. This was all coincidence and it was wildly off the mark.
Mm-hmm.
And they encouraged both of them to stop cooperating with the police.
Yeah.
But as the investigation went on, Atif and Sebastian were living really well in Vancouver with some of the money Atif had inherited from his parents' estate. They bought a convertible, rented an apartment, invited their friend Jimmy Miyoshi to live with them. Behind drawn curtains, they hid from the media, who were constantly in pursuit of them and their story. But what they didn't realize was that they were now the targets of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, or the RCMP.
Mm-hmm.
And in April of 1995, Sebastian and Atif were Canada's most famous teenage murder suspects. The boys had a plan to make their fortune and live out a lifelong dream. They started work on their very own screenplay about two best friends accused of murdering a family. They called the screenplay The Great Despisers.
Is this speculation or is this what they're actually doing?
This is what they're actually doing.
Oh, okay. So now they're like Canada's Menendez brothers.
I guess.
Okay. All right.
And then April 10th, Sebastian was leaving a salon after a hair appointment, I think, when a stranger approached him asking for a ride to his hotel. The stranger then took Sebastian to a bar and bought him a drink for his trouble. Sebastian told this stranger that he and his buddies had written a screenplay. Sebastian said he didn't have a job and needed financing. The stranger said he knew someone who could help. Sebastian thought he was about to meet a connected businessman, but he actually met with Sergeant Hazlitt of the RCMP working undercover.
What?
The RCMP, which spent months preparing to pull off this operation, posed as professional mobsters and set up their first meeting with Sebastian in a strip club. This is a technique used in Canada called Mr. Big, in which suspects are recruited to take part in fictitious criminal activities on behalf of a fictitious crime boss called Mr. Big. Through these activities, undercover RCMP officers build trust with the suspects until confessions to unsolved crimes are elicited.
This is shady shit.
Oh, yes. Both the ethics of Mr. Big tactics and the veracity of resulting evidence have long been under scrutiny, as such tactics are illegal in most countries, including the United States. So the crime boss tells Sebastian he has cash to invest in the screenplay, but Sebastian would have to earn it. Sebastian had no idea, however, that he was being offered work in a make-believe world of crime.
Right.
Jobs were also promised to Atif and Jimmy.
Okay, Jimmy's the roommate.
The roommate, yeah, the third wheel. Sebastian's first assignment was to transport a stolen car for the crime boss for $200. Then Sebastian and Jimmy went from one bank to another laundering money. For a day's work, they were paid $2,000 cash. Months went by, and the undercover operators took Sebastian to fancy hotels, trying to build trust and draw him out. The mobsters slowly brought up the topic of the investigation in Bellevue, and Sergeant Haslett tried to draw Sebastian out by telling him he already knew what happened.
Oh.
Sebastian didn't admit guilt, but he confided in the mobsters that if the police did find something to tie him to the crime, he might want them to destroy it.
Oh.
And he has a very practical theory, Sebastian does. As one of the best-known murder suspects in Canada, Sebastian is confident that his movie would make millions if he's suddenly proven innocent. Mm-hmm. So the businessman raise the stakes and tell Sebastian that the Bellevue police have physical evidence tying him to the crime. And to make it real, Sergeant Haslett shows Sebastian a phony memo on Bellevue police letterhead detailing the evidence linking Sebastian to the murders.
God, this is so problematic. Does Bellevue PD know that they're doing this?
You know, in all of my reading, I did not find that, but they have to. I'm almost positive that Bellevue PD is like talking to the RCMP in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. I'm positive of it. Mm-hmm. The mobsters offer to destroy the so-called evidence, but they need Sebastian to tell them exactly what happened in the Rafe house the night of the murders.
You don't need that to destroy evidence. Look at me. I'm all rooting for the... Sorry.
And then finally, on July 18th, 1995, 1 year after the murders, Sebastian meets Sergeant Haslett at the Ocean Point Resort, and the cameras are rolling. Quote, he walks into this hotel room and takes off his shoes. He stretches out on a love seat, and it's at that point he lets his guard down, and the dirty little secret that he's been protecting for the last 12 or 13 months starts to unravel on video for the whole wide world to see.
Jeez.
It had taken 3 months of undercover work to get to this moment. The next day, Sebastian brought Atif to the crime boss to tell his story, which was recorded on an undercover tape. It's all the police needed to hear. Quote, those were solid, strong confessions that only the individuals that were responsible for that murder would be able to sit down and tell it like it was, says Sergeant Haslett. So okay. Sebastian, Atif, and Jimmy were arrested, but the case is just beginning. Sebastian says he was lying and that undercover officers had intimidated him into making a false confession. I believe that if I crossed them, they would have killed me, says Sebastian.
Well, I'm sure he does believe that if he thinks they're like mob bosses and shit. And why has Jimmy been arrested?
Well, that comes to play later.
Okay.
But no sooner were Sebastian and Atif arrested than the same Canadian government that set up a trap to catch them led an international battle to spare their lives. And the case went all the way to Canada's Supreme Court.
Okay.
Sending the boys back to Washington State meant that they would face the death penalty if convicted, a punishment that Canada had abolished years prior and considered inhumane. They won't extradite to a death penalty country if that is what the other country would seek to impose as punishment.
Wow, we've now established the one thing that Canada's legal system has done right.
Okay. So far. So after 6 years of legal wrangling, while the two were held in maximum security pre-trial facilities in Vancouver, the King County prosecutor in Seattle agreed to Canada's demands not to seek the death penalty.
Okay.
Sebastian and Atif, now 25-year-old men, were finally extradited to face murder charges in March of 2001. If convicted, the penalty would now basically be life without parole. They were appointed a team of attorneys. Representing Sebastian was Teresa Olson, a public defender who believed in their innocence, and she worked tirelessly on the case, running down leads and witnesses. But in the summer of 2002, the case would take a bizarre turn. Guards at the King County Jail reported seeing Teresa having sex with Sebastian during an attorney-client meeting.
Teresa, no. I mean, okay.
This well-publicized scandal caught the attention of national media and brought the trial to a grinding halt. The judge said he had no choice but to dismiss Teresa from the case.
Sorry. Oh, my God. I don't know. It just keeps getting...
weirder and weirder?
Yes.
Sebastian's new attorneys were a dream team, Ivy League trained Jeff Robinson and Song Richardson. With Amanda Lee, they were among Seattle's best and most expensive criminal defense lawyers, but they agreed to take the high-profile case at a public defender's wage.
Wow.
The two had a joint trial that lasted about 6 months that started in November of 2003. And the real linchpin was that the judge ruled those Mr. Big confessions, while obtained illegally per U.S. law, would be allowed in trial.
No. That's a weird legal loophole.
Yep.
Okay. All right.
And Jimmy was used against them as well. He avoided a conspiracy to commit murder charge in exchange for testimony about their plan and how they pulled it all off.
Okay.
Both men were found guilty on 3 counts of first-degree murder and sentenced to 3 consecutive 99-year terms.
Is there any physical evidence? They're hinging this on a confession after being threatened by Mr. Big.
Yep.
Wow.
And then in 2017, after many appeals had already been exercised by both men, a documentary was released on Netflix titled The Confession Tapes that left most viewers, as well as the documentarians themselves, questioning this verdict. The confessions definitely read as coerced, using underhanded tactics, and a website dedicated to the innocence of Atif and Sebastian lays out a bunch of information that counters the official police investigation narrative. In fact, 3 separate innocence projects believe the two are innocent: the University of Washington's Innocence Project Northwest, the Idaho Innocence Project, and Innocence International. Wow. So, for one, the police suspicions of the two came from their assertion that Sebastian and Atif behaved strangely the night of the murders and the following days, that they failed to show emotion after finding Atif's family murdered, that they didn't cooperate with police, that they purposely missed the funeral and fled to Canada.
They were sent there. Ugh. Okay, sorry.
All of these things both men say is not true. Atif asserts he did not even know about the funeral and that the police were informed that they were leaving for Canada and did not have an issue with it. Also, anyone would act strange after finding their whole family murdered.
No shit.
Additionally, there's evidence that exonerates them, according to this website dedicated to the two men's innocence. The neighbors independently confirmed the murders happened when the two were known to be out of the house. Mm-hmm. Murders were completed before 11 p.m. Mm-hmm. There was never a single piece of evidence tying them to the crime scene. Like, everything that they built the case on was vibes and those Mr. Big confessions.
Vibes. And I know that these are 2 unusually intelligent 18-year-olds, but you cannot pull off something like that and have no physical evidence. There's no blood on them anywhere. There's no, I mean, come on. That would be real fucking sophisticated.
Right? Mm-hmm. No blood, bone, or tissue was found on either of their bodies or clothing that could possibly suggest involvement in the murders. And then there was physical and circumstantial evidence that pointed to other killers. And this evidence suggested that at least 3 people, none of them Sebastian or Atif, were responsible for the murders. Investigators found physical evidence at the crime scene that they believed must have been left by the killers. This key evidence was tested and retested, but was found to only contain DNA that did not belong to Sultana, Basma, Tariq, Sebastian, or Atif. There was a coarse body hair or pubic hair found on Tariq's fitted sheet. DNA in the downstairs shower mixed with Tariq's blood. And DNA in a footprint in the garage mixed with Tariq's blood. Whoa. Ross Gardner, the state's expert who examined the blood spatter evidence, concluded both in his report and in trial that at least three people were in Tariq's bedroom while blows were being struck.
Three people that none of them were the family, like three intruders.
Right. Or there were three people in there. Okay. While on the stand, this expert said, quote, "I cannot explain the stains in any other way." There had to be three people in there.
Wow.
The Bellevue investigators didn't just have physical evidence telling them other people murdered the Raffays. They also received three independent tips, all vetted by other law enforcement agencies that clearly implicate other parties and other motives, among them Islamic extremism. You can follow the links in my sources if you want to go further into the rabbit hole on that stuff. But suffice it to say, there are a lot of people that believe there is plenty of reasonable doubt in this case.
No shit. This is awful.
The Supreme Court of Canada ruled in July of 2014 that some Mr. Big tactics yield evidence that is not admissible in court. In light of this ruling, several past Mr. Big convictions may be eligible for appeal, including this case. As of July 2018, appeals for Sebastian Burns had been exhausted, and Atif's final appeal at the Federal Appeals Court in 2023 was denied.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
Why?
Because you know how this works, Amber. The Raffay family murders. That's the one I had been looking for.
That's awful. Poor boys, God. Wow.
Yeah, sister. Apparently Tariq had worked on some kind of computer program where he had determined, based on his computer program, that Muslims in North America had not been praying at the exact right position to be facing towards. There's a very specific direction east that because they pray towards, depending on where you are, they pray towards Mecca.
Mm-hmm.
And there was like some religious, like Muslim extremists that were like basically pissed at him about that.
Hmm.
Because he was like, you know, his views on the Quran and his findings in this program or whatever. Cause they were like, he was basically saying like everyone in North America is praying in the wrong position. Or something.
Oh.
And that was one of the tips. It was one of the independent anonymous tips that came in. One of them came into like the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
Like literally like legit tips came in that were like, there was another tip that came in about there being like a hit out on Tariq.
Yeah. Because when you were first describing it, the first thing I thought was like business associates or something that has to do with business. Cause it sounded like.
And one of the tips that came in, I was reading, literally talked about like a couple of men and like a bat, like a bloody bat in their car. And this was very specific information prior to the Bellevue police ever releasing to the public that they believed a bat had been the weapon.
Mm. And Tariq was hit like quite a bit more than
the worst. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, God. Those poor boys.
Yeah. I mean, they're like practically old men now. They were like only a couple of years older than me when this happened.
Oh, don't call them old men then.
Well, I mean, they're like in their late 40s now. And they've been in prison this whole time.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, that's fucking terrible.
Yeah.
Terrible. Wow. The best. So if they've exhausted their appeals, then the best that they could maybe hope for would be what, like either the governor like exonerates them or an Alford plea, which sucks, but
yeah.
Oh, wow.
But it sounds like they're still like an Innocence Project, like, you know, working on their behalf. I'm not sure.
That's good. Ugh, I hate it. Well, that's okay. I've got another one that fucking sucks, and it's a mamma jamma. So buckle up.
Let's get into it, sis.
All right. I have for you today the Duggars.
Oh, no.
Yes, I know.
So, are we going to be talking about the Quiverful? Oh,
yeah. No. I hate even saying that phrase. It's so gross.
It is gross, right?
Yeah.
I know quite a bit about this because I've listened to some deep dives on the Quiverful, which touched on the fact that the Duggars are part of that. You know, Mike Pence is part of that movement, right?
Yes. Yes. So
former vice president.
Yeah. So feel free to jump in and weigh in wherever you see fit. The Duggars.
Oh, all right. No.
So Jim Bob Duggar was born, I know, fucking Jim Bob, in 1965 in Springdale, Arkansas. He is the second child. His dad was really bad with money and home life was a little rough. And so Jim Bob started becoming really engaged in his local church. At the age of 17, he met 16-year-old Michelle Rourke while he was going door to door with a friend to talk to people into joining the church.
Mm-hmm. What kind of church is it at this point? Because there's only a few that do the door to door thing.
I don't know. I feel like they're not Mormon or Jehovah's. They're just like, I don't know. I don't know.
Where was this again? Where was this?
Arkansas. Southern Baptist, maybe?
Southern Baptist?
Yeah.
Yes. I never really think of Southern Baptists as going door to door, but what do I know? I've never really been to the South, so.
Well, this was also a long time ago, so who knows?
True.
So Michelle was not from a religious home, but she had recently decided to dabble in religion a little bit. So she invites them in and they talk about the church and Jesus and all the things. And after leaving Michelle's house, Jim Bob was smitten. Mm-hmm. He wanted to be her spiritual leader and he prayed that she would be his. Initially the feelings were not mutual. But when Michelle got a job at the yogurt shop where Jim Bob's mom was the manager, it put these two in each other's paths again, and the two became friends. And it was after one day of hanging out where they had a 4-hour long conversation about the Bible that the two officially became a couple. They bonded over Jesus.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So they were married in 1984. This was before Michelle was even 18. They both worked in real estate and invested in properties. And in 1988, they had their first child, Joshua James Duggar. Michelle was using birth control like in between pregnancies so that they could actually plan for the kids, you know. Okay. Imagine such a thing. But Michelle's second pregnancy resulted in a miscarriage. And when Michelle went to the doctor, he told her that birth control is what caused the miscarriage.
How does this man have a fucking medical license?
I don't know, but that's just not true, people.
No,
so just know that that's not true.
That's definitely not true.
Yeah. So Michelle goes off of birth control. Because she's like, oh shit, well, I did this, right? And then it gets even more Jesus-y. In 1990, she gave birth to twins, Jana and John David, and Michelle and Jim Bob believed that God blessed them with twins to make up for the baby that was lost.
That's not how that works.
Nope. And that this was God's way of telling them that the birth control was bad and that they made the right decision to no longer use it. Like, okay, I'll give you your baby back. Stay on the righteous path.
This is very like Job, right? Like I take everything, but then I'll give you like a replacement family. It's fine.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
So this is when they decided for Scherzes that they were never going to use birth control again and that family planning was to be left in God's hands.
Holy shit.
So from 1991 to 1997, the Duggars had six more kids. Jill, Jessa, Ginger, Joseph, Josiah, and Joanna.
Stop it. Are all their kids' names start with a J sound?
They all start with a J, even Ginger. Mm-hmm. I'm not kidding.
Oh my God.
Okay.
All of them, even when they get up to like 27 kids or whatever it is?
It's 19. It's only 19, but yes, all of them are Jay.
It's only 19.
After Jim Bob, because he's the head of the family.
Oh my God. I hate this so much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I hate everything about
this. I fucking hate Ginger with a J.
We haven't even really gotten into it yet, and I'm already mm-hmm. ready to flip fucking tables.
Mm-hmm. Don't flip the table. Your mic is on there. Okay. In 1988, they had their second set of twins, Jeremiah and Jedediah. So
88?
Or 98. Okay. So now they're at 11. Mm-hmm. And so let's talk about the Quiverful movement. You can weigh in.
Okay.
So the Quiverful movement comes from Psalm 127 that states, "Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward like arrows in the hand of a warrior. So are the children on one's youth. Happy is the man who has his quiver full of them." Oh, I don't like talking about a man's quiver full. Mm-hmm.
This is very like, what's his name? Raji or whatever. Ronnie, like spreading his seed.
Yes. So basically, in layman's terms, they're setting out to make their own army of conservative Christian people. Yes.
Right. And this actually goes back. Yes. And this goes back to like the late 70s. There's a pastor who started this. There's a pastor who started his own offshoot of Christianity based off of this concept. And it's a Christian cult.
Mm-hmm.
And they have some very, very horrible ideas about family structures, a woman's place in that structure, and what they're here to do. And it is very much, yes, like you need to have as many babies as possible so that we can have a Christian army that can then go out into the world and take on leadership positions within government and work our way up until we have control of like every level of government so that we can bring Christian law to the United States.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Mike Pence making it to vice president was like the feather in their cap. They were one step away from the presidency. Like they've been working on this for like 40 years.
Oh God. Ugh. They're, okay.
My understanding is that the Duggars, Joe Bob and Michelle?
Jim Bob. Joe Bob, don't matter. J Bob.
That they were literally a part of this church. Like they knew this pastor. Like they were brought, they got sucked into this cult.
Yes. And Jim Bob is definitely, he dabbles in the political sphere in Arkansas. We'll get to it. But
yep.
Okay. So let me get this out, and then I have a follow-up question. I have a follow-up right. question to my own research for you, because you seem well-versed.
I mean, I hope I have answers. I'm not. It's been a while since I did the deep dive, but
yeah. Okay, so they're making a Christian army. It also says that marital fertility is the number one indicator of social health.
Uh-huh.
It also states that a woman needs to provide sex to her husband on demand.
Of course.
And your body doesn't belong to you, and you are required to submit to his demands.
That's right.
So my question, like, for you, like, at this point, like, Michelle sucks. But at some point, do you think that she was a victim in this? Or, okay, I used to, full disclosure, like, again, like, last episode, I had full disclosure watching Teen Mom. I've watched Sister Wives. I have. You know what? I'm just going to say it.
Okay.
And I feel so conflicted on like, are these women oppressed or are they perfectly happy?
I mean, I can't tell. I think you can sign up for your own oppression. But I think it's like, it's hard. It's that question of like, how do you end up in a cult to begin with, you know? And like, and I think that in a situation like with Michelle and Jim Bob, right? Like, she married this man. They, their common ground, the thing that triggered them actually being in a relationship was this religious conversation and understanding and shared belief. And so, especially since he wanted to be her teacher, her guide, her spiritual, whatever, like, so fucking gross. But like, you know, she's coming from like we're talking about an earlier time. We're talking about a very religious area of the country where like some of this, it's like these beliefs that you're like sharing now about the way that like the Quiverful movement like operates and like believes in, they're just like more extreme versions of basic Baptist Christianity. You know what I mean? Christian ideology anyway. It's like, I can see how one could be kind of just moved in that direction, especially if it's your partner, you know, if you're isolated with this man and like, do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's like, on the one hand, yes, I think that she is a victim because I think in most cases, most women in these circumstances are victims because most churches victimize women in some way, oppress women in some way. That's what makes these religious institutions fucking suspect to begin with, right? So it's like she was already a victim of Christianity before it even got extreme.
Yeah.
But also, like, there's brainwashing in that, for lack of a better word, right? I mean, you have to be brainwashed to be put into a cult, to, like, immerse into a cult and feel like you're choosing that.
Well, and she started on this path at the age of 16, so it's not like... Just in general, the idea of submitting to sex when you don't want to is just so triggering for me. It's so
totally.
It's so gross. Okay, so yeah, it also has information about the dangers of using birth control in this movement, and that because they believe that life begins at conception, any birth control is abortion, aka murder.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
I mean, these are the people that are pushing these laws that are like...
I know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So all of their daughters were taught that it was God's will to serve the men in their lives. They were not allowed to wear pants, only skirts, because it was their responsibility not to cause men to lust.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. The girls even had a code word, which was Nike. And they would say it for the boys in their lives. And that meant they needed to look down if an attractive woman was walking by.
What, to help them not look at attractive women?
Yes. Mm-hmm. All of the kids have to even swim in their clothes. The boys swim in jeans and the girls swim in long skirts. Swim skirts.
Yeah. That's dangerous.
I know. And wet jeans. So gross. Okay. And everything in this belief system, if things go awry in the realm of sex, it's the woman's fault. So
of course,
if another man looks at your wife, it's because your wife is being sexy. But if a husband cheats, it's because the wife wasn't sexy enough.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Girls are taught to be very fearful of sexuality until their wedding night, of course. And at that point, they're supposed to be just
vixens.
Yeah. It's so sad. They don't have any kind of sex education at all. They don't know. They know nothing. Anyway,
it's abuse.
Yeah, it is. In 1999, Jim Bob took a job in politics as a member of the Arkansas House of Representatives, which took him out of town a lot, leaving Michelle at home to homeschool and care for 11 children. So Michelle and Jim Bob created a buddy system in which older children were assigned to younger siblings to care for. And that older sibling was in charge of everything: dressing, bathing, schooling, feeding, everything.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. But this was only the older sisters. There was no parenting assigned to the older brothers.
Oh, of course.
No. Mm-hmm. Even if like,
and I don't want to jump ahead, but my understanding mm-hmm. is also that like these girls do not get the same education. They are not encouraged to do anything besides be prepared to be wives and are married off. Some of them quite young.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's abuse. So let's talk about their schooling. That was a good segue. They were homeschooled and their curriculum was the Bill Gothard teachings of the ATI, which is Advanced Training Institute, which was the curriculum for the Institute of Basic Life Principles.
What, so you just tossed a fucking word salad into the air, Amber. None of that meant anything.
And it won't even after I explain it because it's bullshit. So in 2014, Bill Gothard, he's basically the David Miscavige of this Institute of Basic Life Principles. He resigned after over 30 years after multiple women and girls filed sexual harassment and assault allegations against him.
Is so this that, the guy that started the Quiverful movement?
No. Well, no, I don't think so. He started the Institute of Basic Life Principles, which is an offshoot of the, I mean, it's part of the Quiverful movement, but it's.
Oh, he's in the cult. Mm-hmm. He's not the leader of the cult.
No. And this guy, like his whole shtick is about marriage and how to raise children and how to raise girls. And the man has never been married and he has no children. So that's perfect. Just a perfect. Side note. Yeah.
Expert.
Okay, so the curriculum is lessons for families to guide them through conflict. One of the lessons was about moral failures for the family, such as when an older son is sexually assaulting his younger siblings, legal action shouldn't be taken. Instead, the son needs to repent for his sins, and there needs to be an acknowledgement that this abuse likely happened due to immodesty in the home on the part of the girls.
Holy shit.
That's part of the lesson plan.
So they're not mm-hmm. learning math. They're not learning how to read. They're not learning.
No, they do. But this is what they're reading. So the lesson plans also instructed parents to always make sure that their daughters were modest and that the boys should never be exposed to a naked human body, not even changing a diaper, which is really fucking gross to right, link like, those things.
Right.
And of course, that further perpetuated the girls taking care of all the children. So,
of course. Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Of course.
There is also guidance in this curriculum about what to do for the abused girls. And it says that sexual abuse, this is going to be so bad, Naomi. So bad. Sexual abuse can be considered a moral vaccination.
I'm sorry. A fucking what?
A moral vaccination. For example, in the book, a woman who would have had sexual fantasies and she knew what was wrong was one day raped and she no longer wanted to have sex. So the rape cured her.
But then when she gets married, she's supposed to show up on her wedding night ready to fucking go.
That's different. Okay, so they also had at this basic life principle, whatever, they had annual conferences that the Duggars, you know, would attend. And like Bill Gothard was like Uncle Gothard to them. Like they were, right? So right, they were this tight. Is, mm-hmm. So this is really odd. So the Duggar kids were not allowed to watch TV, have alcohol, or get tattoos. They were on TV, but they'd never seen TV. And yeah, so they don't
that the TVs start showing up.
That comes in a little bit, but it was really weird because some of them even went on to say that they didn't even know what a celebrity was or like how it works. And so when they were like recognized after being on TV, they didn't understand why, because they had literally never seen TV.
Oh my.
Uh-huh. This one was my favorite. They weren't allowed to listen to music with drums because drums would invite the devil.
I mean, have you ever been in a drum circle, Amber?
I've known some drummers. They can be the devil-like for sure, but also devilish. Like tempo is important in music. Just throwing that out there.
Like, does a tambourine count?
I think so. No percussion.
None.
Okay, so if they were in a courtship, they were not allowed to kiss or hold hands. The only contact they were allowed was a 3-second side hug.
Oh, and, Christian side hug.
Mm-hmm, and all of their dates had to be chaperoned. They were not allowed to be alone together. And Jim Bob had trackers on all the kids' phones.
So they weren't allowed to watch TV, but they were allowed to have cell phones?
Yeah, but I think they were like flip phones because they weren't allowed to be on the internet. Okay.
This is like, wow. Okay.
So Michelle, she didn't grow up this way at all. She used to wear pants. I used to wear pants. And she was a high school cheerleader.
What?
And she's so ashamed at how devilish she was. And some of her family no longer is in contact with her because of her lifestyle. And Michelle has an older sister, Evelyn, who is gay. And the two have no real relationship. I think they both strongly disagree with each other's.
You think?
Lives. I'm like, can we find something to connect over? I don't know, a soup recipe, something.
There's no common ground here.
Yeah.
Well, you said that she wasn't even raised religious. Like, her family's not religious.
No, no. I mean, she has gone on record talking about how she is so grateful that Jim Bob basically saved her because she was doing all the wrong things, wearing pants and cheerleading. And she almost turned into a skank. Thank God for Jim Bob. Like, seriously, she was on a bad path.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm. So then they had three more kids, Jason, James, and Justin. Keep up. Then in 2002,
we're at 14 now?
Yeah, 14.
Okay.
In 2002, Jim Bob ran for Senate. He didn't win, but this is how he first got the attention of TV producers.
Oh.
Uh-huh. So in December of 2004, the Discovery Channel did an hour-long special called 14 Children and Pregnant Again. And this was a special that walked through a typical day at the Duggar house. They showed their chore charts, which were called jurisdictions. It covered the birth of their 15th child, Jackson. Mm-hmm. And in 2006, the next special came out called Raising 16 Children.
Jesus. And
this was a 1-hour special and it featured the birth of Johanna. The last special in 2007 featured the birth of kid 17, which was Jennifer. So these little specials got so many viewers that the Discovery's sister channel, TLC, offered the Duggars their own show called 17 Kids and Counting. And this went on for 10 seasons. And then, of course, changing the name to 18 Kids and then ending at 19 Kids. Mm-hmm. So during these
10 seasons?
Yes.
What are people?
I've watched it.
I've never watched a single episode.
You know what, though? This was okay. So I'm glad that I know more. I mean, I'm not glad that I know this, but this was like the ultimate version of like going on somebody's social and feeling shitty that other people have some magic thing in their life that you don't have. I don't know what you call that phenomenon where you're like, I used to watch this and I would think this, because, you know, she has this voice that she uses, which isn't her natural voice, which is very high pitched and very, everything is such a blessing and all my children are such blessings. And I used to, before I knew what the seedy underbelly, I was like, this woman has more patience with her 19 children than I have with my two. Their house is immaculate. Everybody is polite and kind. And what the fuck, man? Everything is just, it's just such a joy and such a blessing. And, but, you know, I feel a little bit, I'm doing okay.
Yeah.
God, Jesus Christ. So, okay. So during their 10 seasons, they got to 19. They had Jordan and Josie. So that's 19. Uh-huh. Michelle had some pretty serious medical issues during her last pregnancy with Josie. And this was documented on the show. So
just the last one, just on 19.
Well, probably
every other pregnancy was fine.
Probably not. But this one was particularly scary and it just happened to be caught on camera. So she had an emergency C-section at 25 weeks and Josie weighed only 1 pound, 6 ounces. Yeah. She was in the hospital for several months before she was able to come home. And once she was able to come home, she was assigned to Jana. So now you have a teenager caring for a very sick preemie. Yeah.
And how old is Michelle at this point? She's in her 40s at least. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. Jeez.
During filming in 2015, Josie, the littlest one, who was 5 years old at the time, had a seizure while Jana was caring for her. And Michelle and Jim Bob were out of town. Jana called 911 and Michelle is just like totally chill about it. And she like goes on camera and refers to it as one of Josie's little glitches.
I mean, I imagine that if you're bringing home babies and then handing them over to another child to care for it as soon as you get there, like how bonded is she even with like most of her kids at this point?
I know. And how do you have any kind of, even people who have 2, 3, and 4, you know, a normal amount of multiple kids need to really be mindful to carve out time to have a special one-on-one relationship with each of them.
Yes.
So how can you possibly do that?
With 19? You can't.
You can't.
It's not happening.
Mm-mm. Yeah. Yeah. So Josie had a little glitch. So they get a lot of public backlash about basically being absent parents, and the older kids are growing up and starting to be interested in dating. And Jim Bob and Michelle have a lot of fucking rules. Mm-hmm. So Jim Bob and Michelle are included on any text thread that is happening with couples. And Jim Bob had a questionnaire that young men had to fill out if they wanted to court one of his daughters. The questionnaire was 30 pages long. There is a financial section, an essay section where they need to write their testimony. What is their relationship with their family? What their methods of parenting and disciplining children are? Because also they're super into corporal punishment. And they want to make sure that other people are too.
So they're big proponents of abusing children, and they want to make sure that their daughters are dating boys that also want to abuse children. Got it.
No softies. So in May of 2015, right after Josie's seizure, an article is published regarding Josh Duggar. The article states that Jim Bob failed to report Josh's alleged sexual offenses to authorities, and this snippet of information started to pull back the veil on the Duggar family, and it fucking opened up Pandora's box. Shit starts to go bad. It was learned that in 2002, one of the younger sisters reported sexual abuse in the home. Josh was 14 at the time, and he admitted to molesting one of his younger sisters at night more than once, and he confessed this to his parents. And the parents saw this as a feather in their cap because they had raised their kids so well that Josh felt comfortable telling them. That's what they said. But Jim Bob and Michelle failed to do anything about it for more than a year, during which time Josh continued to molest more of his sisters. And when Jim Bob finally reported it, the police took no legal action. And the punishment was left for the parents to decide what to do. Because, of course, he's like rubbing elbows with politicians and.
Right.
Yeah. So they're like, I read in one spot where they, because, you know, they ended up with that monstrosity of a house after they became famous. And their solution, their solution at one point was that they redesigned, like all the daughters are in a room, all the. Whatever. So they basically created like a Jack and Jill situation where the parents' primary bedroom, like you had to go through their bedroom to get to the boys' room and the girls' room on either side. And that was their solution. So that if a boy was, or if Josh was trying to go into the girls' room in the middle of the night, he had to walk through his parents' room.
That solved all the problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So no legal action.
Wait, so when this story came out at mm-hmm. the time, Josh was already like grown and out of the house, right?
Married with several right. children of his own.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So several more months went by and some of the daughters and a babysitter came to the parents again and complained of sexual abuse. So Jim Bob met with a few of his church leaders about it, including Bill Gothard. And it was decided that Josh would go to a Christian counseling program for 4 months. But it wasn't actually counseling. It was Bill Gothard's properties that were being renovated, and Josh just did manual labor. And then after 4 months, he came home and apologized and problem solved.
This is very Scientology of them.
Yep. So in 2006, the Duggars are scheduled to be on the Oprah Winfrey Show. But just before their appearance, an anonymous friend of the Duggars sent Harpo Studios a letter letting them know that shit is not good in this family. Don't give them a platform. So Oprah contacted law enforcement, and finally an official investigation was launched. And she also denied them access to her show. Like, kudos to Oprah for some things.
One time Oprah did the right thing.
But unfortunately, the statute of limitations was already up and there was nothing that could be done.
Mm-hmm. But we're not done because there's more.
Yeah. So back to this 2015 article. So the initial abuse complaints are made public. TLC immediately cancels the show and removes old shows from the air. But there are several supporters of Josh and the Duggars family. Several right-wing Christians speak out on their behalf, stating that they are a good family and that all families have mistakes. Josh's wife, Anna, makes a statement and says that she knew about the abuse before she married him, and Josh had repented for his sins and had been forgiven in the eyes of God.
Mm-hmm. I hate this so much.
I know. Jim, Bob, and Michelle made a statement that said, quote, back 12 years ago, our family went through one of the most difficult times of our life. When Josh was a young teenager, he made some very bad mistakes, and we were shocked. We had tried to teach him right from wrong. That dark and difficult time caused us to seek God like never before. Even though we would never choose to go through something so terrible, each one of our family members drew closer to God. Jessa and Jill, who were two of the victims, went on record and said that this happened a long time ago and that they had already forgiven Josh. And this coming out 12 years later was re-victimizing them, and they wanted to move on and put it all behind them. But I also read in one report that when they came out, I don't remember, it was like an interview with somebody, Barbara Wawa, I don't know. And they said that Josh was in the room looking at them while they were being interviewed. And they were like, we love our brother and we have forgiven him and it is okay. Yeah. So Jim, Bob, and Michelle also said that they took steps to protect their girls, such as the bedroom, putting locks on their doors. And they had the girls wear leggings under their skirts at bedtime.
At no point did they sit their boys down and explain to them that it's not okay, that we don't do this.
I don't know. So at this time, Josh has a total of 5 victims that we know of, right? So Josh and his wife, Anna,
all his sisters,
and one babysitter who was a minor. Yes. So Josh and his wife, Anna, took their own steps by subscribing to this app called Covenant Eyes.
What?
Covenant Eyes.
Is that on the Apple App Store?
Okay. It's a Christian-based app tracker that will alert your spouse if you're looking at anything inappropriate online. Okay. To make sure, just an extra precaution that this was in the past. He no longer was going to, do bad things, et cetera, et cetera. But what Josh did, and you'll probably understand this better than I did, I'm just going to regurgitate what I read and hopefully you can explain it in English.
It says device-wide accountability to live a porn-free life, monitor your devices with powerful AI software, block porn, and restrict access to explicit websites.
Mm-hmm.
It says Covenant Eyes, accountability, and porn blocker.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay. So Covenant Eyes. But what Josh...
Sorry, I had to look.
No. Is it currently downloading or what?
I don't want them to block my porn. Someone.
He created a Linux hard drive.
Okay.
That couldn't be tracked by Covenant Eyes.
Uh-huh.
Okay. You know what that is?
Well, Linux is open source software. So it's like, it's not Microsoft. It's not Apple. It's...
Like the dark web?
No, it's just an operating system that's like outside of like those operating system platforms. So
okay, so he
So he worked around it.
He worked around it. So he's working at the family car dealership. And one day the FBI show up and take him in for an interview.
Uh-huh.
And they tell him that they have evidence that someone was looking at child sexual abuse. Huh. So even though he had figured out a way around Covenant Eyes, he wasn't able to keep it secret from the authorities because he's fucking dumb. Mm-hmm. And he is charged with 2 counts of downloading and possessing child pornography. He's 33 years old at this time of his arrest.
Yeah.
While he awaits trial, he is not allowed to live at his home because he is restricted from being around children, not even his own. Mm-hmm. His wife is standing by him.
Stand by your man.
Yep. Even though mixed in with all of this shit, Josh is also discovered to be on the Ashley Madison site, which is specifically designed for affairs. And do you remember when there was the Ashley Madison hack and they released all the names? He was on there too.
Also, we also found out during that whole thing that like 99% of the women profiles on Ashley Madison were like fake accounts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like bots or whatever. Yeah.
Right. Right. So it's also learned that Josh paid the extra membership for the affair guarantee.
What is that?
On the Ashley Madison site, you can pay extra for an affair guarantee. But apparently there was a sex worker that came forward that was on this site as one of the sex guarantee, you know, people. And she said that she had sex with Josh Duggar. And during their encounter, it turned extremely violent, which was not something that was discussed or that she agreed to. She said that she sustained physical injuries and it was violent enough that it made her feel like she was being raped. She filed a lawsuit against him that she ended up dropping. And it is speculated that he paid her privately.
Mm-hmm. With that TLC money.
Yep. Cool on the TLC tip. So back to the legal proceedings. He was staying with a member of the church and had an ankle monitor on. But he was ultimately found guilty of 2 counts of receiving and possessing child sexual abuse materials. His family wrote letters asking for a light sentence. His wife even wrote that he is the kindest man she knows. And I'm not going to...
Who basically raped a sex worker.
Raped a sex worker. And apparently what was found on his computer was horrific.
Oh no.
Horrific. And like toddlers.
Oh, for God's sake.
So we're gonna not get into that. It was bad.
Okay.
And they have 5 little kids.
Right.
So
they're building their quiverful army of Christian warriors or whatever.
Right. Okay. In May of 2022, he was sentenced to 12 and a half years in prison. He is currently in federal prison and will not be eligible for parole until after 10 years have been served. His family and his wife, Anna, continue to support him. Since all of this, Jill and Ginger have both left the Basic Life Principles faith and have been outspoken about their experiences.
And well, at least a couple of them got out.
Yeah. I read Ginger's book.
Oh.
Yeah. It was sad. And again, it like highlighted like when I'm sitting here watching what seemed to be like perfect children, she was talking about how she just had chronic, constant anxiety. That if she even thought that boy is cute, like she would have full on panic attacks. Like I'm going straight to hell. Like, Yeah. Yeah. Terrible. Fucking terrible. I don't know, like, I know I can't imagine that his wife wants to stick around, but she doesn't know what else to do. I don't know. There was like this whole Save Anna movement and she was like, I don't want that. Like, I love my husband and blah. And it's like, do you? He can't even safely be around his own children. Like, what are
Does
you supposed to do?
Not know about like the kind of child pornography they found? Does she not know?
She has to. It was made public.
Right?
Like they had kids from like the age 6 down to infant at the time. And it was like toddlers. Like there was a couple of sources that were like what was found was so horrific that we're not even going to talk about it. Ugh, so scary.
Mm-hmm. I'm like, this is the one, this is the thing that we know about.
Oh, right.
You know,
mm-hmm.
this mm-hmm. is the stuff we know about.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows what we don't know about?
I know.
You're telling me that out of those 19 kids, however many of them were boys, that Josh was the only one.
Yeah. And there was a lot too about how, because he was the first and because he was a boy, like he's Jim Bob and Michelle's like extra special one.
Yep.
You know, it's just,
yep.
Oh God, it's so gross. It's so gross.
So gross on so many levels in so many ways for so many reasons.
Well, and then two of like the two sisters that have gotten out, like they're both married. And of course their husbands needed to be Jim Bob approved and they seem fine and happy, but I'm also like, would that have been the spouse you would have chosen had you gotten out right. first?
Right.
You know?
So they got out after they got married?
Mm-hmm. And to their credit, like both of their husbands are very, they seem very kind and they're like, yeah, fuck that guy. Like, we don't need that, you know, but still.
Maybe they jump like, through the hoops just to like, right? Like they.
I mean, they're still very, very Christian. Don't get me wrong.
Right.
But I don't know. I don't know. It's complicated.
It's like, I like Jesus. It's his followers I'm not a fan of. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Holy shit, sister. That was, wow.
It was a lot.
That was a lot. We made it. We did a long one today.
We did. Thanks for hanging in there, Chaos Kids.
Hey, yeah, we appreciate you. We hope mm-hmm. that wasn't too much for you.
No.
Well, sister, we did it. We got to let everybody know we're on all the things. Go follow us on all the things. Mm-hmm. You know, we haven't heard from anybody in a while. We'd love to see a little review on the app that you listen on, or, you know, send us an email and say hi.
Join the Patreon. $5.
Join the Patreon.
Yeah, $5 a month. Bonus episode. Regular episodes a day early. Virtual wine nights. Do it.
We promise we're going to do that again. We're under 30 though. So,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
you know, bring a friend, as some people would say, bring a friend, get friends in here. Sister, I love you.
I love you. That was so chaotic. Goodbye.
Bye.
Wine and Chaos is produced by 8th Direction Records. Artwork by Joshua M. Davis. Music by Paul Abner. If you would like to support the show, you can visit our Patreon page at crimewineandchaos.com/Patreon. Cheers.
Damn, I can't remember. I can't remember the name of it. Susie remembered the name of it. And I was like, yeah, I think that's it. I can't remember what it's called now. Anyway.